Happy Tuesday, everyone. Thank you all so much for joining us for the second day of National Public Health Week. Very, very excited to be with these experts on urban planning, public health, community health, and all those intersections. I'm looking forward to just the expertise and all the insights that they have. Before we get into introductions and everything, I just want to do a little grounding. So I created a post. So if you don't follow me on Instagram, be sure to follow me at the PH Millennial. We're talking about healthy neighborhoods and public health. Our built environment has a huge impact on our health. Where people live, eat, sleep, work, play, learn, and pray drastically affects communities' health. Healthy neighborhoods consist of places free of pollution, safe spaces to recreate like parks and green spaces, healthy built environment like sidewalks and bike lanes, access to nutritious and affordable food. Healthy neighborhoods are the foundations for healthy communities. This all should start with intentional community planning and urban planning efforts to ensure health equity is centered. There are 25-year life expectancy gaps between high and low opportunity neighborhoods across the US. Our environment is inextricably linked to our health outcomes. Health is linked to race and place. Fostering healthy neighborhoods is essential to create more equitable outcomes. What can be done? Well, today we are here with Deepika and Miguel, who are experts in the intersections of public health, urban planning, and healthy neighborhoods. And I'm looking forward to learn and share more about healthy neighborhoods with you all today. So before we get into introductions, I just want to ask, how are you all showing up today?
Hey Omar, I hope it's okay to start. I'm Deepika Andavarapu. My philosophy is basically curiosity. I think that is like the driving force for a lot of us. I'm always a curious person, and I think when I heard and learned about the podcast and had the chance to be invited to this place, I just was very curious. And also, as you can see, I love talking, I love socialization, I love learning about people. So I'm showing up with a lot of curiosity and a lot of learning to do.
And for me, hi Omari, I'm Miguel. And today I'm showing up with a lot of excitement. I've been working in public health for over 10 years. And this week, Public Health Week, it's really, really important for us public health professionals. So today, for instance, I got up and I went for a run. I love running. I love staying physically active. And I'm just very lucky that I live in a neighborhood where I can do that, but not everyone has that opportunity. So to be able to talk about the importance of the role that the design of our neighborhoods has to do with public health is really special and very important to me. So I'm just so grateful and thankful for the invitation to share this space with the two of you today.
Truly is my pleasure, and just shining through on that expertise on this topic. So, anyone that's joining us, be sure to hit that like button. Be sure to share this with someone who gets some value before we dive deep into this conversation, because there's a lot of insights that are going to be shared here today. So, before we get into the conversation again, I would love for you all to introduce yourselves and just give us a little brief background about your experience and how you've gotten into this field.
I have a PhD in urban planning, and I have been in urban planning space for over 2 decades now. And I practice as a city planner in across the US in Tallahassee, Florida, California, Texas. I think in 5, 6 years ago, when after I graduated, after I got my PhD, I set up my own consultancy, Deep Consultants. We provide diversity, equity, evaluation, and planning consultancy. And I like to say that I have been in my lane, but public health has come into the urban planning lane in some ways. I'm really fortunate that I get to work in that intersection of community engagement, civic engagement, urban planning, public health. And I have had amazing experience working with people like Cradle Cincinnati, which tries to reduce infant mortality in especially Black moms in Cincinnati. I'm also working with Change Lab, which is working on affordable housing issues across the country. It's a national exemplar. So there's a lot of really great movements happening in and around this place. And being a solopreneur, being the one person army, I get to do a lot of fun projects. projects, both in public health and urban planning space.
That sounds really exciting, Deepika. I'm so grateful to hear about your path. I started planning about 20 years ago as well. I graduated in 2001 from Cal State University Northridge in Southern California. And I started actually as a geography major. Urban planning just came to me by accident because I didn't know it existed. A student who was part of that program came early that morning to a class that we both were taking. It was a quantitative geography class. And she was sharing with me the things that she was learning about. And whatever she said was so powerful that that particular day, I changed majors. And that was the best thing that I did to be able to find a career in which I've been able to grow. So I practiced traditional planning, if you will, for about 10 years. And during the last big recession in 08, I got laid off and I had to find another gig, and I was able to work as a community planner for the U.S. Marine Corps. I did that for about 2 years, and then this opportunity to work at the intersection of public health and planning came about, to work on an initiative by the California Endowment called Building Healthy Communities. And that was an investment, a 10-year investment in 14 of the most disadvantaged communities of the state. And at the time, the Department of Public Health was going to be partnering with a city, with the city of Coachella. And they needed a planner. So they invited me to apply for the gig. And I was very lucky to get it. And I've been here working for the Department of Public Health at the intersection of planning and health for, since 2011, so over a decade ago. But it's really, really an amazing field working at, you know, that place of planning and public health.
I'm seeing people coming into the conversation, so be sure that you hit and like, share with a friend. You know, greatly appreciate you all being here and being part of the conversation. Leave comments, ask questions, because I will raise those questions up. I see that Carice says, isn't it awesome when your passion finds you? And I think that speaks to a lot of us in just living our lives, doing work, and then finding public health in different ways. But before we get into more of anything, I just want to hear, like, what is urban planning and community planning? Can you all give us like a maybe a definition or background so we kind of understand and ground ourselves as we go into the conversation today? Before we get back to the show, Omari here, founder of the Public Health Millennial. I've started a community and I'd love for you to join. Really wanted to create a space to connect with other public health people, keep up to date with new public health trends and just the latest in the field, a space to ask questions and learn actionable ways to build your professional or personal public health brand. So be sure to join our community. The link is in the description or at thephmillennial.com/join. Prices will go up after National Public Health Week on Monday, the 8th of April. So join today. I look forward to having you and building a stronger public health community together. So join below. And now back to the show.
To me, urban planning is that public-private space, like that interaction between the public-private space. You have like your house or your porch where you get to be part of the bigger community, right? Like you, and you have inside, you go in, it's a private space, but once you come into that public private space and slowly the streets, the shops that you go to, the places that you visit. And I think a lot of the times we don't realize it, but these local governments play a huge role in how the cities do not just appear, they're designed, they're built, they have rules and regulations, they're formed. So there's a lot of analysis, thinking, planning, roads, intersections, the buildings, the zoning, a lot of policies, public policies have an impact on the communities that we live in. And I think the public, especially in US, federal, state governments have sometimes, a lot of the times played a role in how the cities that we have known and grown up in have changed over the decades. So I think we're coming to a circular time. I think we had the huge moments where you had the urban areas were very lively, were very eclectic, were very welcoming, and then you started this boom of automobile, and then you had these big highways, and then there was a white flight, people were getting out of the city, and then you have this urban cores that are completely dismantled and taken, all the resources are taken away. And a lot of the times, the cities or the design of the cities has an impact on the people living in those communities, especially people without resources that were stuck in the downtowns, without grocery stores, without walkable neighborhoods, without parks, without anything that kept the community together. Those are the ones, those communities and those people suffered the consequences. So that is where the urban planning and the public health kind of intersection comes in, because the communities that you live in, that you work and that you play, do get to decide the quality of your health. And as you said, in across the US, if 25 mile, not even 25, like there are zip codes which are like just next to each other with the 25-year life expectancy difference. And even when you go up above, you can see wherever there's a tree covers, where there is dense, beautiful landscaped yards, and then you have the urban dense core with zero parks. And that is exactly what we are seeing is the result of those policies and the federal and state regulations that put automobile above and beyond people and communities. So I think we are kind of digging ourselves out of the hole now, but it is going to take us a lot longer.
And for me, a definition of city planning, I don't necessarily have an academic way of describing it. You can Google it, it's very easy. But the way that I, when I think about the profession, not necessarily the profession, but how planning manifests in our communities, usually I think about the time when I was not a planner, and you know, I was just a person, and you know, I lived in a place, and I would go to other places, and I would take public transportation or walk or ride my bike or whatever. But I never really thought of why do we have a shopping center here, or a parking here, or how come we don't have a zoo in here? We should have a zoo, right? At least in my mind, sometimes I would think randomly about the place where I lived. It was just the built environment was there. But I never really, I don't know, asked the question, how does that happen? And when I learned about planning, it was an aha moment. It was like, wow, okay, so this doesn't exist here by chance. Somebody actually thought about it. And maybe not just one person, but many people. And as you begin to learn about planning, planning is not done by just planners. It's a collective effort to create a place. And one of the easiest way for me to describe planning, I usually use the idea of the general plan. In a general plan or comprehensive plan is a constitution for development for any community. And in California, we have general plans, and there are chapters that every city has to address in this general plan. And that's a really sort of nice package to understand what planners work with. And basically, there's seven required elements. And this is a very easy way to remember how it works. So the first chapter is on land use. And land use is pretty straightforward to understand. It's how we use the land. So land is everywhere, right? Land and sea. In this case, we're talking about just the land. Do we use it for housing or commercial development or for schools? Whatever it is, right? We use this idea of land use, and typically every city has a map that describes, okay, in this area we're going to, it's planned for housing, or this area is for parks, and so on and so forth. And then the other chapter that general plans address is the topic of housing. So as I mentioned, in the land use map, you will have areas dedicated for either single family homes or multifamily and those kinds of things. And planners go really deep into describing how development will occur. Now, the other portion is circulation, how we move around. And, you know, people think in terms of transportation sometimes, but I like to use the idea of circulation, because when we think about transportation, is sometimes in our minds it's a motorized way to get around, but circulation means walking or biking or strolling, those sort of things, and planners look into that. Then the other chapter is open space, and the open space simply is using land for habitat conservation or regional parks or national parks. We have to dedicate places for nature to exist. And sometimes our built environment actually eats up a lot of the areas that are, you know, dedicated for open spaces. So we have to be very cautious of that, and we need to plan for that. Another element is conservation, because we also have to dedicate land for places to grow our food, for instance. So, you know, we just can't take land that is we use to be able to grow what we eat. And again, development is taking over those chunks of land that maybe they may not seem really crucial today, but into the future, you will need that land to be able to grow your food. And then there's safety. And safety now has a lot of different connotations, especially with climate change and, you know, the implications of major natural events that could cause flooding or heat illnesses and those sort of things. And the last one is noise. And it's really amazing that planners focus on noise, because it's like, okay, so why is noise important for planning? Because you don't want to have incompatible land uses. You don't want to have an airport next to a housing development, because noise is one of the biggest triggers of stress. And stress is one of the biggest precursors of chronic diseases. So I'm going to leave it there. That's my definition of planning.
Appreciate that a lot, because that definitely does give us a good framework and understanding of planning. And as I came into public health, I just saw how important neighborhoods and built environments are. And I think we also think about the fact that many of the built environments are huge investments that really aren't easy to change once they are put down. And I think, to Miguel's point earlier, sometimes we know that people have intentionally created inequities within the built environment, within lack of access to whatever it may be, which creates these health disparities and health inequities. Both of you shared that you were planners before you understood what public health was. Deepika shared how public health came into urban planning. Miguel went through his story of being a planner, then the recession happened, and then shifting into more of a public health urban planning role. Can you tell us more about how you all found that opportunity at the intersection of public health and urban planning? Because I see it as very fundamental in a lot of ways.
Yeah, I think that's, I think it's so interesting, because I think the traditional way of work, I think, has gone for most of us, like at least for me. I am like extremely fortunate that I'm able to build a career that works with my work-life balance, that works with my passions. I'm able to go for jobs that are something that I've been passionate about, and I can do so. My career trajectory is kind of very interesting. It's kind of a mix of the immigration issues and a mix of personal issues. But I came to US in 2001 to do my master's in planning from University of Cincinnati. I graduated in 2003. I was a urban planner, quote unquote, traditional city planner across the country from 2003 to 2009. But in 2009, I did my PhD in urban planning. By the time I graduated from PhD, I had two kids under four, and I'm like, I'm no way going to do the academic craziness with the publish or perish. So I just looked for opportunities where I can. I have a huge skill set. I have experience as a planner. I have a PhD. I have research experience. So I was able to kind of make a path for myself and carved a niche for myself. Took both of those practices and. Established my business in 2019, and I've been lucky and just kept going. And I think the big thing is your ambition and your dreams, they need to be big. That's all. Like, those are the only two criteria, and you can go wherever it takes you. And I think it's also like, I think we are in one of the best cultural times in many ways because of the ease of access, the way we can network, the way we can grow, the way we can talk. So I think it's definitely the huge advantage for the millennials and the Gen Zs that you are coming into this space with this amazing experience. You're able to talk and learn from everywhere that you grow. So yeah, I think this is a great time to build a career.
Yeah, and for me, the first thing that I would say is that there is this idea that actually all planners are public health professionals, but not all of them know it, because everything they do, absolutely everything, has an implication on public health. So if they know a little bit about what they're doing and how their recommendations or actions are affecting public health, then they can do it intentionally. If they don't, the outcome is going to be by chance. You know, things will be good, but they may not be. And we have examples, actually, you know, that we can point out when planning has really provided mechanisms for communities to thrive, and when also planning has actually provided mechanisms to harm. And when I say harm, sometimes I like to think that it's unintentional, but when we look at policies across the history of this country, we can see that there's patterns where harm is actually intentional to provide for ways to deprive people from opportunities. So I want to say that because if you are an urban planner today here in this space, know that you are working in public health. Now, if you are a public health professional, there's all kinds of different ways to collaborate with urban planners. Because again, planners have this ability to bring people together, work with different kinds of stakeholders that have different technical capabilities. And what public health brings is the data, not only the data, but actually the empathy in how we should care for the communities that, again, have been left out of getting the opportunities that they should have. So, again, I came into planning by accident, but I also came into public health by accident. Because when I was working for the planning department in Riverside County at the time, it was probably in 2007, 2008, the public health department started to come to the planning department to find ways to collaborate. And that was very forward thinking back then, because there wasn't really collaboration between planners and public health professionals. And that led to the adoption of the first health element in Riverside County. Remember, I mentioned seven chapters into the general plan In this case, the public health department was able to convince the planning department to add an optional chapter on public health. Now, the implementation is a different story, but the fact that we were able to collaborate with them was really a pioneering moment for our county. At the time, there wasn't much movement. There were some things going on nationally, but not like it is today. Today, it's just happening. And I'm really, really happy and grateful to see all of that. But when I came in to public health again, I was going to support the development of the health and wellness element for the city of Coachella, which was a very similar document to what we did with Riverside County. And again, those two efforts were extremely forward-thinking. And I think some of the outcomes today have really made a difference. If you visit the city of Coachella today, it's very different to the way that it used to look like 10 years ago, especially in their downtown area. If you go there now, there's all kinds of greenery, places for sitting around, public art, and all that really started with small conversations. So that was my journey, my initial journey into public health. But it got me to the point that I don't know, it just drew me in that now I actually enrolled to get a master's in public health. I'm on my finishing my first year at Johns Hopkins University. And it is just fascinating. You know, if you get into the field of public health or planning, those are two of the best professions that you could ever find.
I love that. I love that so much. And just for anyone that is wondering more about either of your stories, I will have both of them on my Public Health Careers podcast, sharing their stories, talking deeper about how they got into this intersection that we were planning. So be sure to subscribe so that you don't miss that in the future. But I really, really appreciate your lifting that up. I think there were a lot of great, great ways. And just to take away, like, public health and urban planning are linked. Like, we mightn't have seen it in traditional ways, but today is very apparent in how our environments are built and how that affects our health. And I think to the point of, like, collaboration and ensuring that we have the voices of those communities and just the intentional planning to ensure that things aren't created as inequitably as they have been in the past is there. So as I said earlier, please feel free to ask any questions in the chat. We got our first question from Carice, and she asked, do you find it difficult to advocate for the things that it is hard to tie to a dollar amount? For example, psychological factors in protecting green diversity for the future generations.
I think we have come to a place where there's a lot more, at least the organizations that I have worked with, they are completely very aware of a lot of these issues. So, for example, one of the organizations that I work with is Jefferson Collaborative for Health Equity out of Philadelphia. And they are, when I first started working with them, they were a really small organization, and they were primarily providing community health worker training and that kind of stuff. But now they have become one of the most important arm for the Jefferson Public Health System. They are being seen as the leaders across the hospital system. They are being asked by the leadership and everybody else in the community to come and participate. So there's a more increased awareness of the role of public health. And some of, so it is getting, but I think it is still difficult because a lot of the public health is still situated in a kind of like a, if it is situated in a traditional hospital setting, it is kind of seen very prescription oriented. The community health worker will talk with you and say, oh, take your medications, go to the doctor. And it's always still like the individual's responsibility. So what we are trying to do in those spaces is we're trying to say that the blaming the victim kind of a model is not really working here. So we need to look at the longitudinal issues. If the person is not taking the medications or is not doing a healthy diet, it's not because they don't want to live longer. It's because they are probably struggling with a housing issue. They do not have a fridge. They don't have a working kitchen, or they do not have transportation to get to the doctor on time. So there are things beyond their own personal willingness of taking care of their health. So there is that growth that needs to happen right now, where taking it from the individual person's choices to the social determinants of health to the vital conditions framework. I know we'll get to that later, but it's about the lack of resources in the community that are creating these huge public health issues, that is like the life expectancy gap or the cardiovascular disease risk that we see, or the Black infant mortality. All of these are, which are costing millions of dollars to the healthcare system. They're not because the individual responsibility. It's because we, as a collective, stop taking care of our communities. So I think there is that transition that needs to happen. And I think the challenge is we need to be better persuaders, better messengers, better advocates for those communities. So I think that is the, rather than calling them off or putting them on the spot or canceling stuff, we just need to go into that space, be open and have conversations and pull people together. It's going to take a lot longer, but I think we are heading in the right direction.
I think I agree with you, Deepika. I think things are becoming not necessarily easier, but I think there's more, a little more cohesion in the way that we are now advocating. I think there is a movement from the, I'm going to say, public-private partnerships, and also the role of community health foundations getting in this type of work. And those are making a difference. But we still, at the community level, have a very, I would say, ingrained type of dissonance when it comes to community priorities. Because, you know, communities want to thrive, right? And communities compete with one another. And they want to bring the next, you know, Amazon warehouse to their community because they say, oh, this is going to create jobs, right? And that's how sometimes the arguments are won, by using that idea of the dollar that is going to come to your community. So it's really important for communities to determine exactly what they want for themselves. But the issue is sometimes that the community are large. Again, they don't know what planning is. They don't know that planning is a public process. They don't know that they have a seat at the table. And part of the issue is also that it's almost an exclusive type of process, only for the people who know how the system works and how the decisions are made. So those are the kinds of challenges we face to be able to advocate for what the community really want and what the community really needs. And then we have to understand that the community is everybody. Even investors who may not live in your community, they may have a big stake in the place where you live. So only by putting all the pieces on the table, we can make better decisions. But it's very complicated. It's the issues that we're facing, they're not going to go away quite easily. But it can be done. I mentioned the city of Coachella, and I've seen it with my own eyes, that progress can be made for the sake of the community who lives there. I don't know if I answered your question, but those are a few thoughts.
Yeah, that I think you'll answer it. It's like thinking about that we are getting better than we have been, but we still need to find ways to educate communities about this process, as well as let them know that they need to be part of this process to ensure that we are driving things forward equitably and with them in mind, which I think is important. And before I get to the next question that someone asked in the chat, be sure to hit that like button and share it with a friend. And Curry said, yes, you did answer the question. So thank you all. So the next question is, I'm curious about the challenges of modernizing the built environment and protecting the safe haven of culture and historical attributes of communities that people value.
Yeah, I mean, I think that is so hard, right? Like communities are changing in front of us. Like I think the city that I live in, there's a new development or a new construction or a new entire area is changing so fast. In some ways, it is good because we do need new housing. Like there's a huge housing crisis in this country. There's a lack of affordable housing across the country. So we definitely want to have some more quality affordable housing across our country. But at the same time, we have to be respectful and create and hold that culture and that tradition and that community together. So I think that is where the urban planning and the community engagement piece that Miguel was talking about comes into place, because as Miguel mentioned, it's public planning is a very public process. And I think that is one of the things I really loved when I first came to US, is about how much power that a local government has here compared to India or other countries that I've been in. The cities get to make policies, and there are ways that you can set up a historical district and say, hey, this is our historical districts, and these are the design guidelines. So this, if you want to come to this neighborhood, you have to meet its requirements and you have to follow these guidelines. And I think the public has a huge role. People can come together and put up a community organization or reach out to their local government and kind of put a petition up, or even check if there's something like that exists and if it needs to be updated. So I think there are a huge... there's a lot of opportunity for people to get involved and make their voices heard. But I think it's also important that we make our streets more complete streets rather than automotive oriented. And I think the younger generation especially want to live in communities that are mixed use. They don't want to be driving their car for hours and hours. So they want to be able to walk for their lunch break or go back to their house or sit in the park, there's so many more new ways to travel now. So we have to make our streets more complete and more pedestrian, bike, and scooter friendly, whatever else is coming up next. I think that's important. And I think as a millennials, Gen Z, I think that you guys are going to take over these cities. And I think you have to take interest in these communities. A lot of that, and we have seen this, the school boards or the community boards or the planning committees, the zoning committees, those are all the places that people have to take time and invest and give back to the community. And that's how you shape where you live. So unfortunately, it does fall back on you guys. If there is a change that you want to see, you have to be the change, right? So, but I think that is the beauty of it, is because everybody gets to design it the way they see fit.
Yeah, I think what came to mind is the idea of who cares about a place and why should you care? Because not every place is the same. Even suburban developments that may look all the same, you know, cookie cutter homes, there may be something that is special to the people who live there. So the question is, who cares? Once you begin to ask those questions and you identify that actually there's a number of people who care about a place, then they would come together to discuss how to retain that cultural feel that, you know, I think you mentioned in your question, or how to make sure that it transitions into something that is not going to take away from it existed from the existing feel that you may that the people of today may treasure. But you have to also be aware that places change with people, and people move. People are not, at least in the United States, we're not a monolith. And change is very difficult, actually, to process. We don't like change, especially when we are like, oh my gosh, this is such an amazing place where I live. And then when you begin to see the winds of change, sometimes they may come with fear. And that can actually be detrimental for the well-being of a community. So it's really important to find a way to, again, know who cares about the place, why do they care about the place, and what to do with the place. And again, when I'm saying what to do with the place, is how we can think in terms of making sure that when the change comes, it happens in a civil and orderly way. And I guess that's, you know, I'm just kind of thinking in a very sort of dreamy way, because sometimes it doesn't happen that way. Sometimes the transitions happen very rapidly, and we see that through gentrification. And that leads to displacement, and displacement can lead to homelessness. So there's all kinds of issues, but we have to think about those things before they happen. And we have to plan for change. So those are my comments.
Well, thank you. I think it is a balancing act. And as we know, the one thing that's permanent in life is change, and that happens to communities as well. And I think to your point, it is ensuring that there is that conversation and there is a plan that is done with the community so that the least harm, most benefit comes to the people, to Miguel's point, who care about this certain place for whatever reason that is. So I appreciate you all sharing that. So before I go to the next question, be sure to hit that like and share. Definitely helps get the conversation out to more people. And it is available on Public Health Careers afterwards, as well as on this YouTube channel. So turning to Miguel, what are the key ingredients to improve health outcomes through community planning? And how can we design neighborhoods to prioritize health equity and well-being for all residents?
I'm going to give you a quick formula to actually do something. So in Riverside County, we use a model that was developed by the San Diego Department of Public Health, which is a very simple way to understand how to improve health outcomes. So there's three behaviors, and they have to do with what you eat, with nutrition, and then lack of physical activity, or, you know, how physically you are, and smoking. So those three behaviors, those three things, that's it, nothing else. Those three behaviors are responsible for four chronic diseases, and they are heart disease, pulmonary disease, diabetes, and cancer. These are, you know, diseases that once you get it, it's, you know, it's a battle, right? And those four diseases in Riverside County are responsible for 62% of premature deaths. And when I say premature deaths, that means people are checking out before their time. And those deaths are actually preventable deaths. So you prevent them by preventing your community to catch, you know, to develop any type of heart disease or pulmonary disease or diabetes or cancer. And how you do that? By helping them to change their behavior, to eat better, to exercise, and to stop smoking. How do you do that, right? There's this idea of making available the healthy choice, the easy choice. And to do that, you need community planning. So if you plan a community that actually allows you to do what I did this morning, you know, to run to the park in a very safe way, you know, with no traffic, with a trail that takes me to a park, and it only takes me 30 minutes, you know, a loop. That is a very effective way to encourage me to, you know, either run or walk. You can also plan for local places where people can buy healthy foods, right? Organic food, if you will. And those places also should not advertise or sell tobacco products, right? In that way, through community design, which is policy, you can affect how people behave. And I'm not talking here about, I guess some people think about it in terms of social engineering. It's not that. It's helping people to make choices that will actually help them stay healthy and prevent catching these diseases that could lead them to die before their time. So that is my formula for you.
That makes a lot of sense. And I think it's like thinking backwards to, okay, what are the things that are affecting communities the most? How can we leverage these three things that affect 62% or cause 62% of the premature deaths? And I'll work that backwards and understanding that policy is community planning, community design, and we need to ensure that like all of that is done beforehand. But I appreciate that. That makes a lot of sense and resonates a lot. And before I move on to Deepika, we are getting close to the end here. So if you have any last minute questions, be sure to drop them in the chat. As always, leave a like and share with someone. So Deepika, can you speak more about the vital condition and well-being framework and how it can be used as a tool to unlock pathways to equitable health improvement?
Before we get back to the show, Omari here, founder of the Public at Millennial. I've started a community and I'd love for you to join. Really wanted to create a space to connect with other public health people, keep up to date with new public health trends and just the latest in the field, a space to ask questions and learn actionable ways to build your professional or personal public health brand. So be sure to join our community. The link is in the description or at thephmillennial.com/join. Prices will go up after National Public Health Week on Monday, the 8th of April. So join today. I look forward to having you and building a stronger public health community together. So join below and now back to the show.
Yeah, I think I'll piggyback on Miguel. What he said is a lot of the premature death that we are seeing are a result of the lack of physical activity, lack of the smoking and nutrition. And CDC, and I think one of the words that in public health space, professionals use a word terminology called social determinants of health. So they say there are social aspects of the person's life that are causing them these adverse health results. So we have been using that terminology for a while. So but the social determinants of health is kind of a deficit-based definition. So there's a newer model that Ripple Foundation and CDC and the other organizations have come together and prepared together. And it's called the Well-Being and Vital Conditions Framework. So what this framework, what it says is that for a person, it focuses on very small but comprehensive, just 7 conditions that all people, Miguel, you, me, all of us, depend on to reach our full potential. And they say that for any person to have a complete, wholesome life, they need to have center of that thing is called belonging and civic muscle. That is the center. All of us need to feel like that we belong to something and we have a responsibility, and we have that strong civic muscle. And around that, the other six pieces fit in. The other pieces are thriving natural world, which is the parks and recreation, basic needs for health and safety, so that you can actually walk in your neighborhood without being dreading for your life, humane housing, which is quality, affordable, accessible housing, meaningful work and health, lifelong learning. We all are animals. Like, we all need that strive for that more information and learning and growing. And the last piece is reliable transportation. So the well-being, this vital conditions of health or well-being framework kind of gives us a guidepost, is to say, what is that perfect community look like? How do we build the properties of the community rather than saying, oh, your health is occurring because of these determinants. These are the assets that each community needs to have, happy, healthy people and thriving people.
I was not familiar with this framework, but I'm very excited that you brought it up. And I think it's just additive to everything that Miguel just said and how we do think about like the whole well-being of a person consists of so many different aspects and factors. And I'm liking the idea of maybe flipping that deficit framework and like maybe focusing more asset based on this. So I'm looking forward to looking more into that. And I appreciate both of you all raising that up. So a lot of our conversation today has been around public health, around urban planning, and much of my audience are probably millennials, probably some Gen Z people around there. So how can millennials get involved in planning for health?
I think we, Miguel and I, dropped a lot and lots of hints today. I think you have to first, number one, as Miguel said, you have to care where you're living. You have to be an active participant. You have to pay attention to who's on your community, who is the elected representatives of your community, which direction they're taking the community into. And there is more and more opportunities for civic engagements. So like the hospital systems, they have to do something called community health needs assessment. So as part of their maintaining their nonprofit status, a lot of these communities go through this process of engaging the community members in these processes where how do we improve the community's health. So there's a lot of ways for them to get involved. There is organizations, both nonprofit and community-based organization, nonprofit organizations, and also being part of the elected representatives or even appointed boards. So all of these things make a huge difference. These organizations, these boards, they hold a lot of power and they get to decide where the money is being spent. So it's important for us to invest our time and energy into where we are living and be part of the solution, rather than be part of the problem. So I think it's easier now than before. You're not required to probably go in person, but you can still get a lot of information where you're sitting. It's just a matter of investing that time and energy into that space. I think your voice is huge. It matters. I think your generation has a lot to give. And I think it's important for your voice to be heard because some of these decisions that are being made now will have impact for years and years. And I think as a generation that is most responsible, most aware about the climate change issues and everything, your voice will go a long way. It's time for the change of guard, as it says. So we have a lot more trust in your generation than the us or the previous generation. So I'm really look forward to the changing of the guard and of taking you young leaders taking up space and making their voices heard. So there's definitely lots and lots of opportunity. As Miguel said, you just have to start to care for the community that you live in and pay attention.
And I'll just mention one example. For those of you who may still be students, I would highly recommend that you become a member of the American Planning Association. Membership is free for students, I think for 2 years. And once you become a member, then be an active member. Don't be a passive member, because when you become a member, there's just this immense network at your disposal. That's how you connect with other professionals who will be working on the same type of work that you do or not, but you'll get to learn from various different points of view. We started it's a fairly new group called the Health Equity and Planning Interest Group at APA. So you are welcome to join. I think, I don't know how to provide that information to you, but if you just go to the website of the American Planning Association, search for Health Equity Interest Group, and you can find me there. Connect with me, and I'm more than happy to connect you with others and activate you at that level. But there's opportunities everywhere. You know why there's opportunities everywhere? The reason is because we have so many challenges everywhere, and they're not going to go away next year. There is so much work ahead. A lot of the work is difficult work, and somebody has to do it. And who can be better than well-prepared professionals in planning and public health to get us out of the hole, as Deepika mentioned initially. It's going to be quite a ride. So keep it going.
Well, I appreciate those kind words to my generation and the generations to come. I think there's a lot that needs to be done, as Miguel raised up, and we are excited to take on these challenges and push forward and really create more equitable solutions going forward. So last question before I wrap us up here, and I know we've spoken about it, but how can collaborative efforts between local, state, and federal entities ensure that comprehensive measures are implemented to create healthier neighborhoods nationwide?
Yeah, a lot of the times, I think the things rise up. I think the local governments are the most risky. I mean, they are willing to play some, not risky, I want to say they want to take those wicked problems and test and try some policies. And I think once they are successful, they get to the state level and then they get to the federal level. And I think I'm hesitant to talk about it. So some of these issues, they definitely need federal intervention, like when you're talking about making our transportation more complete rather than more electric fleet, like, you know, all of those, the bigger things, we definitely need federal initiatives, but I think they have to be done in a way that all the culture of the communities are respected. So I think that is what is the role of the collaborative efforts is. The federal government can bring in the big, broad, huge ideas, but I think if you do not respect the state and the local government guidelines or those the expertise that they bring about their communities, that has to be respected. So we have had our hands burned with the highways, you know, how the highways have divided the communities and have shattered the communities. So I'm very hesitant to say we need these big broad ideas, because they can we don't know how they affect a community or a locality. So but I think it's about doing that intentionally and being more respectful and paying attention to that local community's knowledge. So I guess that would be one big thing. And the I think it's something as simple as, like, you know, for example, we have infant mortality is a huge issue, and Black maternal morbidity is another huge issue. And one of the bigger challenges is It costs a lot more to take care of the premature baby that is delivered at 20, 25 weeks, but it's much cheaper to take care of the mom while she's pregnant for that 9 months. Just by providing affordable housing for that mom or providing some safety net, you're actually saving millions of dollars in the long term. So just thinking about how the social aspects or the community aspects would impact or reduce costs in the long run. And there are some really innovative efforts happening. They're talking about the capturing the money saved by providing social support early on. So some of those value-based care efforts that are coming up. So those are the Medicare and Medicaid. They are being very, they're trying out a lot of those examples on a more like a grant by grant basis. But it is interesting that we are seeing some movement at the federal level to try out these new innovative models.
I think I'll just give you an analogy. I think it's important to sometimes think about these things in an abstract way. So when I think, for instance, you said, okay, there's the federal, the state, and local, right? Sometimes legislation from the federal government sort of comes down, top down, but sometimes legislation happens that actually rises all the way to the top. So the analogy that I wanted to say or mention is when you, for instance, think of a song, and I'm thinking of a song from the 80s. I think it's called More Than This. Is it More Than This? I think so. No, it's My Life by Talk Talk. And then Gwen Stefani made an interpretation of the same song. They're very different, but they're the same. You know, they accomplish the same goal. So what I'm trying to say is that, you know, federal legislation is done for a particular purpose, taking into consideration many different moving parts from what they see from up here, right? So it would be good if that sort of plan, you know, federal plan per se, can be interpreted at the local level without necessarily replicating it, because you know every place is different and is unique, but there's certain components that should be there so that if they ever meet together, there's an alignment. So there's no that dissonance, like what is this? What is this noise? But rather there is, you know, a concerted effort to realize a plan that, you know, may be to address climate change. But we need to be able to, again, create that path for making things connect. So that's my answer.
Well, thank you. Thank you for that answer and all the other answers. I really appreciate the conversation today. It has been very informative and very helpful in framing why healthy neighborhoods are so important for healthy people and how urban planning and public health intersect to create healthy neighborhoods. Look forward to connecting with you all more and sharing more about your stories. So you all who are listening or watching this, be sure to subscribe and definitely look forward to sharing more. And if you're interested in more panels, there will be more panels every day of this week for National Public Health Week at 6 p.m. Eastern. Just go to thephmillennial.com/nphw to check out what is coming. But thank you all so much. And
Omari, you forgot to show your sweat, your shirt.
I have
Guys,
a
buy it. That is so cool. We're buying, Miguel and I are getting that one right now. Thank you, Omari. It was a pleasure.
Thank you so much, Omari, for the invitation. It was great sharing the space with you, Deepika.
Thank you, Miguel. Bye, Omari.
Thank you all. Bye-bye, everyone.
Take care. Bye now.